Hi, welcome back to Excited, episode 212. My name is Arvin. Join me as always, Macaulay from PensionPlanPuppets.com. It's Acting the Fooleman.
Hi, everybody.
How you doing, Fooleman?
Honestly, not as bad as it could have been, I guess. That's the best I can say.
Yeah, I think that's a theme for how Leafs fans kind of feel at this point. It's like, yeah, I mean, it's not great, but I don't get the same anger that we've seen in prior years. Mm-hmm. I think because, you know, as people have said, this team is already dead, mm-hmm. right? And I think the writing is on the wall that there are going to be some changes this offseason. Mm-hmm. So we're just immediately jumping right into it. But in case you were listening to this podcast and somehow are also living under a rock, the Leafs lost last night 2-1 to the Boston Bruins in overtime in Game 7 to lose their first round series for the seventh time in 8 seasons.
Truly an incredible streak of first round futility that was briefly interrupted last year, but there's not a lot of evidence that that's the start of a new trend. Let's put it that way.
Yep. So I guess what we're going to do in this podcast, we're just going to talk about what happened, where the Leafs go from here, our thoughts on the team, on what happens next, really. And, you know, sorry, that's sort of a meandering intro, but yeah, like there's sort of a bunch of different things to discuss. And let's just get right into it.
Right. So the Leafs lost a close series to the Boston Bruins. This is hardly unprecedented territory, as we've talked about already. The Leafs have, once again, some pretty good excuses. No one wants to hear them anymore. They do not matter. And I think pretty much everyone knows that we're out of the moral victory stage. I haven't heard anyone saying, like, oh, this was actually potentially a cup-winning team, if not for the misfortune that they experienced.
Right. There's no handshake, or sorry, handshake in the respect line. Respect in the handshake line at this point. You know, we've moved past that.
Exactly. So, having said that, Matthews was obviously not 100%. He left Game 4 of this series, he missed Games 5 and 6, he came back in Game 7, and looked, I would say, still not quite like himself.
He looked fine, but like, yeah. he also only played, I think, 17 and a half minutes, which mm-hmm. is suggestive of the fact that he was also being managed somewhat carefully.
Yeah, there was a bunch of speculative nonsense about him missing games for tummy aches or something like that. If a player like Austin Matthews misses an NHL playoff game, it is, I guarantee you, something that would knock you on your ass.
Yeah, I'm going to say this up front. We'll maybe come back to this in a little bit, but I don't have a lot of time for the argument that these Leafs players are uniquely soft or weak or unwilling to put their bodies on the line to win. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the case of Matthews, and he's just an example here, I think this probably applies to most people on the team. But, like, I don't think you can be someone who comes from really the middle of nowhere in hockey terms, mm-hmm. right? Like, they're not sending the best scouts to Arizona mm-hmm. or anything like that. Like, you know, Matthews had to get himself noticed through his, like, prodigious talent and, like, work ethic. I don't think you come from there to the NHL without being kind of psychotically competitive. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Look, there are obviously hockey players who view it as a job and are not like crazy competitive and don't live and die with it. But I do believe that most players on the Leafs, you know, really, really work their ass off and want to win, because it's really hard to get to the NHL without that, because there are lots of people who really, really want to play pro hockey at the highest level. And you have to be kind of crazily talented to get to where these guys have gotten to without wanting to put in the work.
Absolutely. And I think people reach for these kind of moral explanations because they want it to make sense that the Leafs lost, and they want there to be something that can be fixed. Well, look, even granted that record of first-round failure that the Leafs have mostly assembled over the past decade, they've been in every series. They've been competitive. Almost every first-round series went to an elimination game, to a Game 7 when possible. I know the Caps series didn't. But the Leafs have been right in it. It doesn't mean that they're good enough. But I think it means that when we're trying to identify the problem, I don't believe that it's heart or commitment or lack of grit. This was the grittiest edition of the Leafs, I think, in the Shanahan era. it's just a matter of ability. There's not a lot of evidence that this is a top five team. Like a real yes. bona fide contender. There's not really a case there.
Right. And I want to reference an article that Down Goes Brown had at The Athletic after game four.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a nice article, I thought. And the crux of it was basically like, we keep thinking this team is destined for greater things. And what if they're just not good enough? And it's mm-hmm. not, you know, a question of desire. It's not a question of they just don't want it as much as, you know, Parker Weatherspoon does. It's just these guys are trying their best, and their best isn't good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least not good enough to make it all the way. Maybe it's been good enough to get a round or two more, a round or two deeper into the playoffs than they have. I could buy that. I think the Leafs have actually been a little bit unlucky over the course of their 8-year time span. But I also don't think the Leafs have really put together, you know, consistently put together teams that deserve to be in the conference finals and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I think they've put together some good teams, a few great teams, and don't have as much to show for it as we would like, but also haven't put together, you know, truly, truly elite teams.
Yeah.
I guess put another way, the Leafs have been having these 50-50 series for a while. They're having these series in the first round every year, right? You look at what New York and Carolina did. They just took apart worse teams than them. Right? Those weren't 50-50 series.
Yes, and just because there's an objection that I think some people are going to say, they're going to say, well, New York was playing Washington, who were one of the worst playoff teams in recent memory. But here's the thing. New York earned the right to play Washington.
Right. You earn that with your regular season. Exactly. And when the Leafs have done that, they haven't taken advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Specifically Montreal.
Yes. And if you look at the current positioning of the Toronto Maple Leafs, well, they finished third in the Atlantic, and they went into a competitive 2-3 bracket with Boston, who are a pretty good, but I would not say great team. And so they played a team that was about on their level, and they lost a close series. And, you know, I would much rather that they won and that we were all doing a victory lap over the Boston Bruins right now. But the truth is, win or lose, does this team look like it's really going to win a cup to anybody? No, I don't think so. And I think that's the takeaway. And I think if you took the names off and just looked at the information where it's like, yeah, they're third in their division, there's not a lot of evidence that this team is actually a cup winner in waiting.
If you completely like scrambled the logos and names and whatever, and you said, okay, the third seed takes a higher seed to game 7 overtime, missing, you know, essentially 5 games of the 2 of their 3 best players.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh, okay, like, that makes sense, okay. They lost, but seems reasonable. Now, of course, no one has the patience for that anymore, which is totally fair.
Yeah, I want to be clear. I'm not saying this as a justification.
Right.
I'm saying it's like, if you told me beforehand, okay, the Leafs are going to lose Matthews for, like, half-ish of the series, and he won't be 100% for the rest of it. Marner, probably not 100%. Nylander misses the first 3 games. Samsonov is iffy, and then Joe Wall isn't available later on. You know, if you gave me all that information, I'd say, yeah, the Bruins probably won that series. The problem isn't that I think that and that there aren't reasons that the Leafs were worse. The problem is I have them as kind of a push in this kind of second tier series. They're not seriously talked about as a team that will go all the way and with reason. And that it's a problem that I'm talking about them that way. 8 or 9 years into the Shannon plan.
Yeah, the issue is that this team is just not really an inner circle contender. They finished 10th in the league this year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're 10th in the league, well, 8 teams make it to the second round.
Yeah.
So you're kind of punching above your weight to get there, realistically.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just the theme for the Leafs for a lot of this Shanahan era. They've consistently been, I think, at the bottom of the top tier of teams or the top of the second tier of teams.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been at their best, right? You look at their finishes the last few years in the regular season. 10th this year, tied for 4th last year, tied for 4th in 2022, 6th in 2021. I think those three teams, 21 to 23 basically, were teams that were in the lower part of the absolute top end of teams. They probably could have and should have done a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they had like an expected cups of greater than 1 or anything like that. But yeah, we probably should have won 2 to 3 more rounds.
Yeah.
In those 3 years, especially the North Division year.
Mm-hmm.
Then you go back to 1920. This is the year Babcock's fired. Keefe's hired. They were 12th at the time of the stoppage. First year of Tavares. Before that, they were 7th. Second year of Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner and William Nylander's career, they were 7th again. So top end of the second tier or worse, pretty much.
Yeah.
Right? And in those early years, let's separate it to pre-pandemic, I think the Leafs did actually get a little bit unlucky that the Atlantic had 3 of the top 7 teams, so they faced Boston a bunch.
Mm-hmm.
And they lost competitive series there, you know? But since then, the Leafs have had a few years of being a very good team, didn't make it count, and now they're a good team. And they did sort of what was expected of them, right? Largely, I think that the Leafs are sort of... They're a team that probably should have won 2 to 3 more rounds, mm-hmm. from 2021 to 2023, and then they just never made any upsets outside of that.
Yeah.
But I don't think they've been hard done by, they lost out on so many possible cup opportunities because they were so close and just couldn't get over the hump, and maybe, you know, one little thing changing it would have given them a cup or a finals appearance. You know, they're not the San Jose Sharks.
No, they would have needed a lot of luck, I think, to make a run at it. And yeah, I think we come back to that very fundamental question of how good they really are. Now, the way in which they didn't do as well as we might have dreamt is interesting. This is a team that's built on star offense, produced great offense in the regular season.
Second most goals in the league, I believe.
Yep. But down the stretch, the power play was showing signs of going very cold, partly due to an absence of Mitch Marner, and I don't know how much his recovery from that injury may have impaired him. But the power play stayed cold into the playoffs, and it was really bad. They scored once on 21 opportunities against Boston. So 4.8% conversion rate. That's dreadful.
It is. Sorry, one thing I just want to note before we... I think we're going to talk about the power play for a little bit.
Yeah.
One comparison I want to draw back to the Leafs kind of macro level, mm-hmm. is to the Carolina Hurricanes. You look over the last like 3-4 seasons, with the exception of this most recent one, the Leafs and the Hurricanes have been very, very close in terms of regular season success. It's like a couple of the points between them each year.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hurricanes have made it to the conference finals and never further than the conference finals. They've actually never won a game in the conference finals, I think, in their last 3 tries.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's sort of the playoff experience or like the playoff results that the Leafs have missed out on. Mm-hmm. It's not like, oh, they could have won a cup. It's, oh, they probably should have won a couple more rounds and then bowed out.
No.
Right? And I think that is sort of the issue, right? The issue is the Leafs have been a team that is very good, but hasn't been good enough to really, you know, to really expect much more than around here, around there, and then see what happens.
Yeah, I think this comes down to like a framing question. It's not a question of could the Leafs have beaten Boston this year easily. They could have.
They could have beaten Tampa in 2022 or whatever, the first year.
Yeah, and they could have won almost any of those series. You know, like if the puck goes the right way against Montreal, they win that series. The issue is not could they have won these series. The issue is why aren't we talking about them as a strong favorite to win these series? You know, why were they drawing Boston without home ice in round one? That's the kind of question you have to ask. And you want to build a team that is definitively better than Boston. You don't want to scheme and manipulate this team and think, okay, if we just add this, we can kind of squeeze by them. Hockey doesn't really work like that, where you just think how you're going to beat this opponent or you're going to find that missing ingredient if you're not overall good. And I think that's been the big takeaway. So do you want to do the power play now?
Yeah.
Okay. Power play stank, as I was saying. So under 5% conversion, that's terrible. That's terrible, especially for a team that has all this star offense that it's paying for. It wasn't healthy star offense, again. But that said, even by the standards of a much reduced forward core, health-wise, it was so god-awful. The Bruins looked ready for that slingshot pass entry that the Leafs do, where they try to come over the line together in a line of 3 or 4. The puck carrier makes a pass just before the blue line to try and get it in and then set up. The Leafs also looked rough when they did set up, which was even worse. A lot of common penalty killing nowadays is you wait for the opposing team to mishandle the puck or not get it cleanly, and then you jump on them. And you swarm them before they can recover to make a clean pass. Often you'll try and set up a two-on-one against the boards before they get a clean handle on the puck. It seemed like the Leafs, one, struggled to gain the zone and kept trying to hammer away at exactly the same zone entry. And two, they got kind of jumped on very quickly because the power play was out of sorts and mishandling pucks.
Yeah, I think the Bruins typically have a pretty aggressive penalty kill, and that, to, at least to my eye, seemed to show up here. Anytime the Leafs had like some sort of suboptimal touch, it felt like the Bruins separated them from the puck and then were able to send it down. And then, as you just mentioned, the entries were a consistent issue as well. You know, the aggressive penalty kills are sort of inherently a bit higher risk, right? Because like you get one guy out of position, now you're dealing with like maybe a 4-on-3 or 5-on-3 in that particular play. But the Leafs really didn't show the poise to handle that sort of aggression. And that sort of, yeah, that sort of forecheck, really. No, I guess it's not really a forecheck, but just like, yeah, how to the point the Bruins were. So it was disappointing to see, especially for players who are typically so poised with the puck in the offensive zone.
Yeah, and I have to say it's unacceptable. Like, I mean that in the strongest possible terms, because you can't build a team around this much star offense and have it stink a lot in the playoffs every year. This is not the first time it's been bad. It's the first time it's been this bad, because this is staggering. But it's always been a point of contention, and the Leafs' power play has never been as effective as it ought to be in the playoffs. Maybe that's personnel, maybe that's coaching, maybe it's both. I think absolutely the coaching has to answer for it and will answer for it, to be honest with
yeah,
you.
Yeah, to put some numbers on that, since 2021-2022, the Leafs are second in the league in goals rate on the power play. And during that same time, sorry, in the regular season, and in that same time span, they are 15th out of 22 teams. It's really, really bad. The Leafs average, I think it's about like 9.5, almost 10 goals per hour on the power play in the regular season, and then that's cut down to about 5.5 in the postseason. So it's almost a 50% reduction in success.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you give the Leafs the power play that they had in the regular season in terms of goal results, or even if you give them 75% of that, because you are facing better teams in the postseason, you're facing teams that are more likely to have good penalty kills, good goaltending. Even if you give at least 75% of their regular season power play effectiveness, that's 1 to 2 goals over the course of a series. And as we covered, the Leafs are constantly playing these 50-50 series. 1 to 2 goals may could have and probably would have shifted the tide in at least one or two of these.
Yeah, worth noting, I think the Leafs outplayed the Bruins 5-on-5 in this series to a great extent. They did outscore them 5-on-5 en route to getting absolutely nuked on special teams, unfortunately. It's arguable. The Leafs were better on shots, a little down in expected goals. But I think that they played the game they often wanted to play 5-on-5. Did not do so special teams at all.
No, I think the Leafs were either -5 or -6 on special teams in this series.
Yeah.
So, I mean, over the course of 7 games, you know, you're leaking almost a goal per game that way.
Yeah, like it would actually be kind of remarkable if they won in spite of that sort of deficit, because that puts you in such a huge hole in a really competitive, tightly contested series.
The other thing worth noting, and this ties back to our larger point and our larger thesis from the top of like, this Leafs team is simply not good enough right now. This Boston team's not that good.
No.
They're a good team. They're not awesome. They're playing fucking Charlie Coyle on their first power play.
Yeah, like, look at their centers. I'm sorry, is that a cup-contending center core to anybody? No. I expect Florida to smoke them. Boston might get through and go on a goalie heater, but realistically, no, I don't think Boston is that great.
Yeah, they're a good team with really, like, one game-breaking elite talent in Pastrnak and consistently excellent goaltending and defense.
Yep.
That's enough. They're a good team.
Yeah.
But I don't think anyone's looking at the series and being like, man, that Boston team really impressed me. It's like, no, they struggle to put away a Leafs team that was missing Matthews and Nylander for large chunks of the series. Mm-hmm. This wasn't that impressive for Boston either.
No. I mean, you'd rather win than lose, but it doesn't make you believe that this team is going to do anything.
And that's sort of what makes it more galling for, I mean, for both teams, but like from our perspective, for the Leafs, that this is a 50-50 series. Like, when you look at these teams on paper, and you look at even what they did throughout the year, you know, Boston was not that impressive. This shouldn't be a series that the Leafs should hope to go in and be like, oh, that's a 50-50 series. The Leafs should hope that they are considerably better than Boston. They weren't this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's the bottom line on a lot of these takeaways. I'll also note, I think it's been muted this year because the Leafs have been so bad at special teams. You can't really complain that hard about a penalty disadvantage if you perceive one. The refs were entirely fine this series. They let some stuff go because that's what playoff refereeing is.
If anything, I think they were kind to Toronto.
They were fine. Yeah. And like, I've always thought that that kind of is silly, complaining about the refs. There have been a couple of series where the Leafs have gotten a rough whistle. But by and large, it's a way to take attention away from real problems. The Leafs have no legitimate complaint against the refereeing in this series. Sorry. I don't think they do at all. I didn't talk about the penalty kill in as great detail as the power play because you expect the power play to be good, or at least you ought to be able to, based on the names and talent and cap hits associated to it. The penalty kill was always going to be a bit dicier, but it was a real weakness, especially early in the series. And I think that Brad Treliving was aware of it, and he was hoping to improve it by picking up Connor Dewar and Ilya Lyubushkin and Joel Edmondson. And it was not repaired. And again, that was another thing that really did hurt them. Again, the Leafs were fine 5-on-5. They turned this into a grind fest as it went on, which is what they wanted to do given their injuries and deficits. But they did not really figure out how to operate on special teams, and it probably killed them.
Yeah, through the first part of the series, it was like a little dismaying that the game was so grindy 5-on-5 because the Leafs were just hemorrhaging goals on special teams, and they actually need to kind of put up margins on Boston in the 5-on-5 portion, which they were not doing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It was like even. I think as the Leafs got like more injured, and like without Matthews, you have much less hope of like actually making good on a firefight. Right?
Yeah.
So as the series progressed and the Leafs special teams, or at least penalty kill, got a little bit better, and they were no longer leaking at goals as consistently there, having like a pretty grindy 5-on-5 game was maybe kind of reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, still far from ideal. The Leafs just like didn't generate enough good offense, right? And I think this is the refrain that we always hear come playoff time, which is the high powered Leaf offense, the Leaf offense with sort of the red blob of death in front of the opposing team's goal, didn't get that. Mm-hmm. And look, Boston has something to do with that. I know I just shit talked them for like 3 minutes, but they are a good defensive team.
They are. And Jeremy Swayman is a terrific goaltender.
Yes, but also, like, you know, you have to face good defensive teams to win a cup. And if the Leafs are like completely incapable of generating good offense against a good defensive team, well, then that just goes to our earlier point. They are not good enough.
Yeah, that's the thing I keep coming down to. You know, again, they easily could have won this series. It's just,
it doesn't matter.
It doesn't. Yeah, like it would feel a lot better, but it ultimately doesn't say much about their quest for a cup either way.
Right, like this team is worse than it was over the last 3 years. And to be clear, because people are crazy about this, I am not saying that like Dubas is better than Treliving for that reason or anything like that. You know, there were other structural reasons why the Leafs were worse this year than they were in prior years.
Yeah,
but they were, right?
Age was a huge factor in that.
Yeah, yeah. TJ Brody fell off a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that was a huge difference. John Tavares got a little bit worse. That's a huge difference. But yeah, they were worse this year than they were last year. And who they were last year was like a fringe contender, and they, you know, diminished from that.
Yeah, I would agree. So let's talk about goaltending. Goaltending always comes up in series. It's maybe less of a story in this one than I think it has been in certain prior series. Ilya Samsonov was just okay. He was about one goal under expected in a series where, unfortunately, the opposing goaltending was excellent. Jeremy Swayman played really, really well. Joseph Woll was great in games 5 and 6, but was unavailable in game 7, which is unfortunately starting to feel like a trend. His injury history is pretty rough, and if he doesn't deliver on his very impressive potential, that's probably going to be why. I think it was enough that you'd want, you know, you can always wish for better goaltending, and the Leafs, I suspect, are going to pursue a more definite 1A goaltender. We'll talk about that later. But the bigger takeaway is you scored 12 goals in 7 games, guys. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not going to be enough with anything short of absolutely elite goaltending.
Yeah, I also saw some people being like, oh, you know, Samsonov to Wall, you know, made a big difference. Wall to Samsonov made a big difference in Game 7. It's like, what are we doing here? Yeah. Samsonov let in 2 goals on, like, 33 shots. He saved a goal above expected in the game. Like, sure, maybe Wall would have done better.
Yeah.
Maybe. Like, it's...
Yeah, but, like, okay, so we're a team that can only win if it gets absolute superlative first-class goaltending at all times. Great.
While also spending, like, what, $4.5 million on goaltenders?
Yeah.
Like, you can't square that circle.
Yeah, we want Shesterkin, but we don't want to pay for Shesterkin, that sort of thing, you know? Not that he's even available. But, yeah, I don't think that that's very reasonable. You can be not happy with some of the goals that went in on Samsonov, but I think ultimately he kind of just was what he was, which is like a decent 1B goaltender.
Yeah. I mean, the Lindholm goal certainly didn't look pretty. Yeah. People were criticizing him on that Pasternak goal. I mean, it's a weird balance, and then it's essentially David Pasternak on a breakaway. Like, I'm not going to shit on a guy too hard for not scoring that or not saving that.
Yeah, like, if the standard for good or bad is, can David Pasternak score on you when he gets room? Unfortunately, there aren't a lot of good goalies on the planet, so... Yeah. Again, you know, you'd love to see more there. I think they'll do stuff there. I don't think that's the main storyline, so we won't dwell on it in great detail.
The big, you said it, but just to reemphasize, it's 12 goals in 7 games. Yeah. That's not good enough.
No.
You're going to win so few series like that. It's kind of a miracle that they pushed it to 7. Again, like, you sort of mentioned this off the top. If you conditioned on the fact pre-series, you told me the Leafs are going to score 12 goals. I'm like, okay, well, you know, 12 goals, even if it's a 4-game series, it's only 3 goals a game.
Yeah, it's worrisome, to say the least. You don't win very much doing that. And again, they're supposed to be built on offense. Now, again, we'll say, look, they had injuries to their star players. But the secondary offense, which is one of the things that we pursued, there wasn't enough of it, unfortunately.
Also, to the extent that you think like this top-heavy approach is flawed, it might be flawed because you only have 1 or 2 points of failure.
Yeah. And
right? Justin, like, that's a consideration.
Bourne did an article talking about that. He said, you know, the problem with the strategy is you're one injury away from being non-competitive, it feels like. Now, that wasn't quite the case with the Leafs, but yeah, like, they were really behind the eight ball as soon as any of their stars was at less than ideal health, much less 3 of them. And some years that's going to happen. You know, the Montreal thing, their number came up in terms of John Tavares getting concussed by Corey Perry early on in that series. And that's it. That put them in trouble, and they didn't have enough of a margin to survive that. So we talk a lot about management on this podcast. You know, what would we do? What do we think the general manager is doing? And that's going to be our lens, I think, for the remaining parts of this episode. I don't think Brad Treliving's moves look bad on the whole. I think they're inadequate. But I think he certainly had some things to chalk up to his credit. Max Domi, I think, is the best one. I think you have to give him a lot of credit for that.
I agree with that. I would describe Treliving's additions, generally speaking, as like... as fine, yeah. Right? They didn't take anything off the table when it got to playoff time, mm-hmm. but didn't bring a whole lot extra to it either. I think there were like mistakes. Like Klingberg, I think, was a big mistake that the Leafs got out of and I think got a little bit lucky to get out of.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that happened. So it doesn't really impact what happened in the playoffs.
Yeah, that's very fair. And I think, you know, it was a cautious trade deadline in a lot of ways. Treliving held on to his first. He decided not to be the one to win the bidding war for Chris Tanev, that sort of thing.
As a side note, I mean, we spent a long time talking about how we've thought for this year, you know, this team simply was not good enough. And there's certainly a reading of Treliving's deadline where he thought the same thing.
Yes. Yeah, I don't think that he was deluded about the quality of this team because he didn't go all in on it. Now, the Leafs also have suffered something of a deficit of draft picks in recent years because they went all in several times, or at least bet heavily on teams that didn't end up doing very much. But yeah, it was a cautious trade deadline. Yeah, but to give him credit, Domi put up, you know, decent production, 4 points in 7 games. He put up solid numbers. The biggest thing was he filled in as a top six center when Austin Matthews was out. And yeah. Without him, I don't think that's nearly viable. Also, yeah, made some great
passes.
He
gave the Leafs like a chance.
Yeah, he did.
We were, I think, both fairly low on Max Domi coming in, or at least like lukewarm on him.
Yeah, lukewarm.
I think he played above my expectations over the course of the year. Really rough start.
Mm-hmm.
And he does pose some issues in lineup construction that I think are kind of annoying to deal with just consistently.
Mm-hmm.
But on the whole, I think he was the best addition that the Leafs made this offseason.
Yeah, it's held up. So give him credit for that. Tyler Bertuzzi, I've felt a similar way about him actually a lot of the year. I like him. He's a lovable greaseball. Wish he could finish a little bit more. We really could have used it.
I'm not sure he had a goal in the playoffs, did he?
He had one.
So, yeah. I mean, one goal in 7 games for a $5.5 million player is not ideal.
No, especially when I think a big factor in them getting him is that the previous year he had 5 goals in 7 games.
A lot of that was on the power play. And this is something that we brought up when the Leafs signed him. I think, again, we were both actually pretty happy with this because Bertuzzi came in kind of below what we thought he would get. Clearly, he was, you know, taking a 1-year deal to bet on himself and also on a cap spike.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like, you know, his point totals were always going to be a little bit worse than last year because he wasn't going to be on the Leafs' top power play unit.
Yeah. Although he did get a certain amount of power play time and he proved about as able as anyone else to make the team score 5v4. But yeah, I like a lot about him. It, certainly if money were no object, I'd want to keep him.
He's a good player.
Yeah, he's a good player. I think I was higher on the Ilya Lyubushkin addition than you were.
Yeah, I was. So in the deadline, I was just disappointed that the Leafs basically didn't get anyone who I thought would make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, I think, fairly harsh on Lyubushkin, especially when we talked about him pre-deadline.
Mm-hmm.
I think relative to what I said about him then, he was better than that. Like, he's competent.
Mm-hmm.
But just like a lot of the other defensemen the Leafs had, didn't add anything really positive to the table either. Right? He was just sort of there. Right? And helped contribute to playing Boston pretty even 5-on-5. And, you know, kind of got his clock clean special teams, but that happened to everyone. So, again, I'm not blaming Lyubushkin for that. But, yeah, it's just sort of kind of the same old. The Leafs got, like, a bunch of defensemen who were adequate, right? But clearly had some issues, clearly didn't really, you know, contribute in any meaningful sense offensively.
Mm-hmm.
And when you score, you know, 12 goals in 7 games, everyone's got to wear that to some degree.
Yeah, I think you can say, look, the games that the Leafs played in 5 and 6 that they were sort of forced to play by the absence of Austin Matthews, I think Lyubushkin and Edmondson and Simon Benoit are well suited for that sort of game. Like, they'll absolutely grind it down, and that was effective. You know, it gave the Leafs a chance when they were kind of up against it.
But, and under-talented relative to Boston, like with Matthews out.
Yeah. And at the same time, you can say, look, a player that could move the puck better might have gotten it to the forwards a bit more. Maybe we aren't looking at 12 goals in 7 games. As you said, everyone's got to wear that. Lyubushkin, to give him some credit, had a great assist at one point in the series that was wildly out of character. But still, he gets a point for doing that. I like the guy, generally. And I think that if you are trying to make this work on the cheap, he makes a certain amount of sense as someone you can get away with in the top four. It's just, let's not mistake that for a genuine difference maker. You know what I mean? Like, this team isn't good enough, and if it's going to get good enough, it is going to have difference makers. He's not one. He doesn't have to be, but somebody has to be.
Right. I was on a podcast after game four with Kevin Papetti. Mm-hmm. And like one of the things that we said is like, at a certain point, it's not enough to not fuck up. Mm-hmm. You need players who do things to help your team. Right? Certainly for some parts of your roster, you just want a guy to not fuck up.
Yeah.
But if you get too many of those guys, you just end up with a pretty mid roster.
Yeah.
And on the back end, I think that's kind of the problem the Leafs have. They have a lot of guys who don't do very much. And this is sort of forced in some ways by the area of the market that the Leafs have to play at.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, you don't get guys who are game breakers for $2 million. Or if you do, they have massive other issues.
Yeah. And they clearly wanted or hoped that there was a chance of John Klingberg coming back and being a game breaker. And obviously that didn't work out. But I'm sure Treliving is conscious of this lack. It's just this is the team that he built. And this was the balance that we struck. We got guys who were good, grindy, physical, and effective in that. We got guys who don't generate a lot.
Yeah, I don't think Treliving was like under the illusions that the guys he got on defense were going to fix everything and make the Leafs defense amazing. You know, I have my misgivings with the moves that Treliving made, but when you look at the defense he built in Calgary, it's not a bunch of gargoyles.
No, like, it's a good defense group.
It's a good defense group. There is a lot of toughness and ruggedness. I do believe he values that, but there are guys who can like move the puck there,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's also something he prioritized.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure, you know, if we administered truth serum to him, he would say, look, I was working with the constraints I was working with. Chris Tanev, they were asking me for an arm and a leg. I didn't think that it was justified to spend that price for that player right now. And after that, I had to cobble together based on the resources available. So, yeah, you know, it made sense to me. Having said that, especially if you're going to acquire these kind of grindy players, a big thing that they're for is the penalty kill. And so when you do invest in that and the penalty kill still sucks, that does feel a bit like a failure to me. And again, I don't think that any of them wears it on his own. It's a team failure. And I liked Connor Dewar too, by the way, as a fourth line acquisition. That's totally fine. But there has to be some acknowledgement that there were things that needed to be fixed and weren't that related to the Leafs being out in the first round again. And that's a combination of lack of supporting offense and lack of penalty killing. Okay. So yeah, I guess we can finish up just on the toughness thing. The Leafs were not pushed around this series, if that makes anyone feel better.
No, they if anything, they were the aggressors, right?
Yeah.
And if you want to say, okay, this team was clearly more built for playoff hockey, and maybe you can say, well, they even, you know, played above their talent because of how tough and rugged they are,
mm-hmm.
right? We mentioned all the things that went wrong for them, and they actually push it probably further than you'd expect given all the things that went wrong. Okay, but, you know, they were still under-talented then.
Yeah, you know?
That's a separate issue.
Yeah, like my main takeaway here was, I actually could believe that this team is better built and better suited for playoff hockey relative to its talent level, which is lower. And so, like, you can say, okay, we sacrificed to get a bit worse in general, but more suited for playoff hockey. I get that trade-off. But it seems to have ended up with us in the same place. And again, I defy anyone to make a really strong argument that right now this team is top five in the NHL in real talent level. I just don't think it's there. So it's going to be more than adjusting the ingredients in the recipe. We are going to probably need a new recipe, I guess I would say.
Right. One thing to note also with this Leafs defense,
mm-hmm.
Boston's a pretty weak offensive team.
Yeah.
Certainly by playoff standards. So in that way, like the Leafs defense actually had like an easier time of it than they would against Florida, for example. Worth noting, because I think there could be a tendency to get kind of carried away with how the defenders performed defensively. I think they did a good job. And as you said, you know, once Matthews is out, the Leafs are playing a totally different game where they have to kind of grind and hope to eke out, you know, one goal or low scoring games generally.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the defenders did a commendable job of that. But, you know, they're not shutting down Team Canada over here.
Yeah, it's true. And again, this is where the bar is at. The bar is not be better than the Boston Bruins. The bar is be better than the Florida Panthers and the Vegas Golden Knights and the Dallas Stars and all of those teams of that genuine top caliber. It's not guys who are playing Pavel Zacha and Charlie Coyle as their top two centers, which I'm sorry is not really something that a serious contender can do, in my opinion. So, okay, we've looked a little bit at what happened. Now what is the big question? It is a cliche to say that everything should be on the table, but everything possible, pause for evidence, should be at least worth considering. You have to think about every way that you can improve this team. Some of those pathways are not going to lead very far before you realize you can't walk down them, but you have to at least consider every option. Except something insane like trading Austin Matthews, which they're obviously not going to do, so like let's not totally lose our heads here. But we can start with the coaching staff. I think Sheldon Keefe is going to get fired.
Yep.
So that's it. I don't know that it's really all his fault, but...
No, I agree. I think Keefe is like a fine coach. Okay, so I remember when Babcock got fired and Keefe came in, and my God, the things people were saying about Keefe.
Oh, yeah.
And how much better he was than Mike Babcock, which is probably true, by the way. But like, this is just the nature of coaching. When you come in, you're a hero because you're not the old guy.
Yep.
And the old guy sucked because he got fired, right? Or he did enough stuff to get fired.
Yeah. And there's also like, there's the new coach bounce that everyone knows about. There's also a reason for that, which is that players have a chance to start anew and earn the good graces of the new coach. So teams do play better almost under any new coach. It's kind of automatic.
It's the epitome of the king is dead, long live the king.
Exactly.
Right? So Keith is not as good as people thought he was when he just got hired and invented line matching.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Which
good times.
He's also not as bad as some people think he is now when people are saying, oh, this guy, you know, gets out-coached every single playoffs and doesn't make adjustments. I've seen people argue that Keefe tinkers too much and then also is too stubborn. I'm like, okay, well, these can't all be true.
The thing I would say for Sheldon Keefe in summarizing this series is the team went to a full grind for two games and choked out two victories that probably not a lot of people would have expected. And I think he deserves some credit for that. On the other hand, I think he owns the special teams. And people like to say, okay, that's an assistant coaching accountability. Doesn't matter. If it's not working at a certain level, you are the head coach. You own the acts of your subordinates that you tolerate. And if it's that bad for that long, it's your ass on the line. So 100%
agree. You know? I feel like I'm giving too much of a defense of Keith here. I think he is fine.
Yeah.
He's a fine coach. That's not an argument to keep him.
No, and right. Just something else that people have said to me is, okay, we could do a lot worse. The goal here is not to not do badly, per se. It's to win. Once Keefe has established that he can't win with this group, he's denigrated as a coaching possibility against anyone who might. You know? And his successor may very well not be able to fix the problems that he couldn't. But we have to try, because that's all you can really do.
Yeah. So to sum up, I think Keefe has been given enough time that firing him is like totally reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's a panacea necessarily. It might be like maybe the Leafs find a coach who, you know, really works. There's rumors of Rod Brind'Amour having like contract disputes with Carolina. I don't believe that he will actually become available in any sense.
I think that's Rod's camp negotiating through the media, to be honest, but
I agree. But yeah. Like there are coaches who I think could be an upgrade over Keefe, and it's such a low low effort or like low risk thing to do in some ways, where it's like, okay, yeah, you fire coaches. This is what hockey management does, right? You fire a coach and you try a new one, because it's a much easier thing to change than the totality of the roster, as we're about to get into. And it also is potentially very high impact.
Yeah. I mean, the classic example would be, look what the Vancouver Canucks did this season after going from Bruce Boudreau, who I love, to a full season of Rick Tocchet. Well, credit where it's due to the Canucks, they were a much better team. They were also running very hot for about half the season, but they were genuinely really improved. And that's what you would be hoping for. In terms of other names, Craig Berube, might be an option. If Mike Sullivan is on the outs in Pittsburgh, there is a fun possibility of a coaching swap, where you could see Sullivan winding up in Toronto and Keefe reuniting with Dubas. I don't like, it's more fun to think about than likely, I would say, but you never know. Of course, there are also probably countless names that I don't know of coaches who might be candidates from the lower ranks who might be worth promoting. I do think if the Leafs turf Keefe, though, they're probably going to go with a veteran name.
Yes, I 100% agree. And Keefe will be fine, I think. This is his first coaching job, first NHL head coaching job. He's a pretty young coach. He's going to get another job, and he'll probably be fine there.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that like any future team should be absolutely averse to ever hiring again, which is what I felt about Randy Carlyle at the end.
And as it's turned out with like how toxic he is with Mike Babcock too.
Yeah, no, once I knew about Mike Babcock, like hiring him again would be insane.
Be stupid enough to do that.
Oh God, Columbus. Okay, so that kind of is the most obvious thing. The next question in the front office is Brad for living. I think he's probably safe for now because he's been doing this for a year.
It would be kind of weird, honestly, if they fired, even as someone who is like not that high on for living as a general manager.
Yeah.
It really can't be overstated how bad his like last year in Calgary was.
It was pretty brutal. Yeah.
The Tkachuk Huberto deal. And I know there's probably some ownership meddling here.
Yeah.
But holy shit, that was awful.
Yeah.
And this is not hindsight because we have
tapes.
We said on the podcast, this is bad or it has the potential to be really bad. And it has been worse than we thought.
Yeah, it's true. I will say, I thought it was going to be bad like in the second half of the deal. No question. I thought it'd be really bad. I didn't think it would be really bad in the first half of the deal, which appears to be what's taking place now. But that said, I think in his first year as a Leafs GM, Treliving has been fine.
He's been competent. Yeah. He's been adequate, I guess, is how I describe him, similar to how you described kind of the additions he's made. They've been adequate, but not enough to push the team over the top.
Exactly. Like, he hasn't raised the level of the franchise yet. Maybe he will do so. That's kind of what we have to hope.
He hasn't created any long-term issues yet either, although the long-term contracts that he has given out do give me some worry. Because they're not hugely damaging, but I don't think they're good either. And that's the Reeves and Kampf contracts. And also the Nylander contract is too much, but...
Yeah, I know. We've just accepted that.
Yeah.
So, that's where we're at on that. Brendan Shanahan is harder to evaluate. He's further from the ice. We have less of a read as to how he's perceived by ownership.
I think Shanahan getting fired or not is like... almost entirely about boardroom politics,
mm-hmm.
and not as much about like what his decisions have been.
Yes. It is noteworthy that there is a new president and CEO of MLSC, which is the parent corporation, named Keith Pelley. I don't know what that represents, but anytime the guy above you changes, in the case of this front office, you start thinking, what does that say what they think about me? And so I don't think it's out of the question that Shanahan may be guided to the exits. I would say it's more likely to happen in a year. My understanding is his contract is up in a year or two, but we will see. Shanahan has his fingerprints all over this team, and it sounds like he was the biggest driver of keeping the core together at certain points. Like there have been rumors that Kyle Dubas was maybe more open to blowing up the core than Shanahan was at certain times. We can't be sure of that. We don't know
what happened. Yeah, ultimately, we don't really know. As you said, we have such little transparency into who said what and who wants to do what.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess like it's unclear to me what Shanahan's job is exactly, like on a day-to-day level or like even on a strategic level.
Yeah, but right? I think he has like big decision authority.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think that either Dubas or Treliving would be free to say, I don't know, trade Mitch Marner without his okay.
Yeah.
So, something to keep in mind. That was a fun little hypothetical about trading Mitch Marner. Let's talk about blowing up the big four. The Leafs have four major forward contracts. as you
we should also say, Riley probably deserves to be in this conversation, but it becomes like kind of a non-starter pretty quickly because as much as he has warts, he is still probably the best defenseman on this team.
Yes, and Riley is making 7.5 a year. You don't free up as much by dealing him. And I think that there is probably not much chance of that happening. So Matthews, you don't trade because he's your superstar. You made a good point here that I don't like reading about how his contributions from the regular season to the playoffs seem to go down consistently.
Yeah.
But
so, okay. We should start from the point of, like, you basically can't trade Matthews and remain credible.
Yeah.
He is the best player I've seen play for the Leafs in my lifetime.
Yeah.
And it is unlikely that if you trade him, you will get a player as good as him in a decade. Probably more.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
50 years.
yeah. His what he has done, and I say this without like a pejorative, but what he has done in the regular season consistently, being a top five, top three player in the world, a Leaf hasn't done that in a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
And he is absolutely in the same tier of value in any given year as someone like Connor McDavid or Nathan MacKinnon. I expect McDavid to have a better year than Matthews every year, but mm-hmm. like Matthews has had better years than McDavid.
Yeah.
Right? And he's had similar years to McDavid.
Mm-hmm.
And I think McKinnon's kind of exactly in the same boat. So those are his peers. He is at par with them in the regular season. And then in the playoffs, he consistently has worse results. And that's what separates him from McKinnon and McDavid, and not in a good way. And I don't say this to be like Matthews is inherently flawed or anything, mm-hmm. but I'm pointing out that this has happened.
Right.
Right? And there is some bad luck here, right?
Yeah. I mean, this year, again, obviously he was not himself.
Right. So that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it has to do with the opponents the Leafs have faced, that they probably face slightly harder opponents than Edmonton, for example, on average. But I don't think that's a full excuse at all.
No.
Really.
No.
But yeah, like his goal rate gets cut in half. He goes from a superlative goal scorer, the best goal scorer in the world, one of the best goal scorers we've ever seen,
mm-hmm.
to a pretty good goal scorer mm-hmm. in the playoffs. We can't have that, right? It's at this end of the market, you just got to be great all the time.
Yeah.
You know,
it's unforgiving, but like that's the standard. That's what comes with the price tag.
That's what comes with being in the same tier as these guys who have led their teams to deep cup runs. I mean, I know McDavid hasn't won a cup. It's not his fault.
No. I think that's pretty well established to anyone who's paid any attention. Much as we like to make fun of Edmonton, it's not on McDavid. So yeah, like that's where the bar is, unfortunately. It's unforgiving, but like so is professional sport. So.
Well, and we see this in the NBA all the time. And I think in the NBA it can get very toxic because, you know, players are discussed as failures unless they lead their team to a championship. But, like, that's what it takes to play at the deep end of the pool.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like, and I'm not even saying Matthews needs to lead us to a championship. As I said, McDavid hasn't done that, and no one doubts his bona fides in the playoffs. It's I really want to see a year where Matthews goes nuts in the playoffs. And he's done it for spurts. He's had very good series before. And I think that gets lost sometimes. Matthews absolutely carry, and Marner, to be very fair,
mm-hmm.
and to be very clear, Marner has done this as well. Matthews and Marner were the Leafs' two best players against Tampa last year.
Mm-hmm.
Matthews, you know, single-handedly spurred a three-goal comeback in the third period.
Yeah, and I would say even in this series, Matthews won them game two.
Yes.
So, like, that's one. It's just, I know it sounds like we're saying, like, he has to go out there and win games for them. He does. That's it. It's star offense. It's difference-making offense. Nylander provided it in Game 6, same sort of thing, where he broke through a game that most players could not break through in.
Right. And so like, they've done that at times, but they haven't had enough of them, and they've been interspersed with bad series, like objectively
mm-hmm.
bad series where they are not dangerous enough.
Yeah.
Where they get goalied, and getting goalied can happen to anyone, but again, you play at the deep end of the salary structure, you're supposed to be goalie-proof. You only get to that level because, you know, you're not just a Corsi demon. It's mm-hmm. because you can elevate your own shooting percentage. It's because you can elevate your teammate's shooting percentage.
Yeah.
So if you you know, want to get paid based on that, then yeah, you have to do that even against good teams, even against good goalies. And again, this is all sort of futile to talk about in the context of Matthews because you are not trading him.
No, you keep holding on to him as long as you possibly can. And that is what the Leafs are going to do. So that question is over, but it is worth facing up to the fact. If Auston Matthews is not a superstar, this team is not going to be a contender probably ever. You know, it was a great story that they grinded out those game 5 and 6. That can plug the hole in the boat for a little while. But in the end, when you have a bona fide gold-plated superstar making $13 million a year, you need him to be really, really good. It's just how it goes. Nylander, they just signed, so that's easy. He's not going anywhere. I want to emphasize, all of these players have full no-movement clauses, so they go nowhere if they don't want to.
Yes, and I think people are way, 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 way too, you know, optimistic, maybe not even the right term, but I think people are too bullish on the chances that these guys will want to move.
Mm-hmm.
And Marner specifically. Tavares is approximately 0% to move. He would take assets to dump at this point, and probably a lot of assets, and even if he agreed to it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's like a non-starter. So if you look at this team and you say this is a team built around four core forwards and an offensive defenseman, and they struggle to score every spring, we're investing a lot of money into those five players. We're not getting the results out of it. We need to divest from that group as a whole and get, you know, maybe a broader collection of players retilt to being just stronger defensively, you know, more versatile, whatever, just a different type of player, anything like that. The only possible, you know, thing that can that doesn't get dismissed out of hand is trading Mitch Marner.
Mm-hmm.
And some people really, really, really want to trade Mitch Marner. And I understand the impulse. I do want to say it is not clear that trading Mitch Marner will make this team better.
Yes. So what you do is you go to Mitch Marner and you say, one, I want to know your opening price on an extension. And two, I want to know five teams that you will be willing to accept a trade to. And Marner, by the way, has every chance of saying, I want $13 million a year for 8 years, and I will accept a trade to zero teams because I negotiated for this clause and I want to stay here. And if that's what happens, you have a choice, as Brad for Living, of signing that extension, which is too much money, or walking him to unrestricted free agency. Now, I see some people saying things like, okay, scratch Marner every single game until he agrees to waive his no movement clause to anybody. That is not going to happen because you don't live in the real world. And I know that some people are saying this as a joke, like they just want to like chase him out of town and they think it's funny. There are some people saying it with a frightening degree of seriousness. Don't torch your reputation with every single player in the NHL and provoke what will probably be a union grievance that, even if you win, is really damaging to you as an organization.
It's also like kind of quite unpleasant to go through personally. And I don't mean for like Marner. I mean for everyone. It's like people don't like to do that sort of thing. And one thing to note, okay, so the Leafs are probably going to fire Keefe. We've talked about that. We think that's like a totally reasonable thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
All right, cool. Craig Berube, you're coming in. By the way, you're not going to have Mitch Marner. We're scratching him so we can trade him.
Yeah.
I know he's our best defensive forward and probably our second best forward overall, and you're just coming into a new team. He's part of the leadership structure in this organization, and you need to get the players on board with your message. But yeah, we need you to tell Mitch Marner to sit in the press box every single day.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay, cool. Nice. Thanks for doing that. Like,
how do you think that plays in the dressing room?
Yeah.
And then everyone says, like, okay, it doesn't matter. We'll trade, and then we'll recover, and we'll move on. It's like, you don't think that has any kind of impact in the desire of players to come to your team? Putting aside that you're pretty obviously trying to coerce him to void a contract clause that you signed to. Now, again, the mechanics of it would be interesting. You can say, like, it's within the legitimate discretion of the coach or anything. But it's going to be bullshit to anyone who looks at it for 1 second.
Right. And I think people point out, I think correctly, that, look, other teams are pretty brutal and harsh with players at times, which is true,
mm-hmm.
right? Tampa Bay told Ryan McDonagh, hey, look, if you don't waive your no-trade clause, we're going to waive you.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, they could do that because he has a no-trade clause, not a no-move clause.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't browbeating him into, you know, relinquishing all his rights. They were saying, look, you can either do this or we'll be forced to do to perform an action that we actually legally can do here.
Mm-hmm.
and it'll be worse for both of us.
Yeah.
Right? I don't think that's super pleasant, but that's also very different from saying we are going to scratch you because we can't waive you and just make your life miserable here.
Yeah. I honestly think that, one, they're not going to do this. But two, people seem to be under the conception that even if they could do this, it would be good. And it would not be. Now, you go to Mitch Marner and you say, like, look, we are looking at major surgery. Give us some teams that you are willing to accept a trade to, and we're going to start negotiations. And if you don't do that, we are not going to be able to make this team what it should be. And you're going to be set up for a pretty unpleasant year. Do what you can for us. We'll do what we can for you. Please, please, please. We're begging you. We need to do something. But that's all you can do is ask.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot depends on how he responds to that. Even if he gives you permission to negotiate with, say, 5-6 teams, that doesn't necessarily mean that you take what's offered. You're going to be kind of pinned in this negotiation. Everyone's going to know you're desperate. It's 1 year remaining unless you negotiate an extension.
I think a team would absolutely want to negotiate an extension with Mitch Marner, right? Because as soon as you acquire Mitch Marner and you don't have an extension agreed upon, he has a so much leverage.
Yeah, I think there are teams who would risk it, but it does distress the asset even further. Like, they're going to give you less for an uncertain extension than for one that's already in hand.
Right. So one other thing I want to bring up, like, even the team that is probably discussed as, like, the most ruthless of all teams, Vegas,
mm-hmm.
I don't think they've done anything like what people are suggesting with Mitch Marner.
No, they, like,
Vegas is ruthless because they will trade a guy after acquiring them, like, 18 months ago.
Yeah, they will trade anybody at any time. To the extent that they can do this. But again, the Leafs are kind of in a difficult position here. Again, yes. I'm not saying you don't look at it. You absolutely do look at it. But, like, you know, it's not a given.
The point that you brought up at the start is, like, everything should be at least on the table to be considered.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the line to walk with the Mitch Marner deal is really, 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 really hard.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the extension, because you're trading him at a low point in his value, coming off an injury, one of his worst seasons in memory, which was still, by the way, a very good season for 99% of the league.
Yeah,
a relatively ineffective playoffs, where for some reason all his good passes seem to go to Joel Edmondson. For some reason, that's not Marner's fault, but that was frustrating.
Yeah,
teams aren't going to say, "Oh, we'll give you Clayton Keller." You know, let's give you our cost controlled young player who, like, might be 85% of Mitch Marner.
Yeah, and
that's not happening.
No.
They're throwing us anchors.
Yeah, and that's the other thing is that you were just not in a good position here. Like, if the Leafs were going to do this, they should have done it last year prior to his no movement clause kicking in July 1st. But the Leafs flipped GMs and Treliving's mandate was keep the core together. So, okay, that's a choice that Shanahan made. It's fine. Here we are now. We don't have anywhere near the optionality we once did. And the options may actually be zero. Like, it is very possible you're looking at the same core four in September.
I think it's, like, above 50%.
Yeah.
To be honest, if you ask me what the most likely scenario is this offseason, it's that the coach gets fired. So Keith gets fired. Someone comes in. Not sure who.
Yep.
Shanahan might or might not get fired. And then Treliving signs Marner to an extension. I think that's more likely than trading him.
I think that's very possible. Now, that said, there is going to be a feeling, I think, in the Leafs front office that, like, somebody's got to stop the madness at some point where we keep shelling out huge extensions to these players who have not materialized into a genuine contender. Like, I think that there will be frustration in the upper tiers of MLSC, and they may finally say, okay, we're cutting off the money spigot. But we'll see. The thing is that Marner's salary expectations are just, they sound like they're kind of nuts. And I get that he gets a lot of points, but, like, if he comes in and he wants $12 million a year, I don't think I can do that. Like, I just don't think I could bring myself to sign that extension. So.
And, I mean, the reason I think an extension is likely is because I just think Treliving is not going to want to walk him to free agency.
Yeah.
Now, Marner is much less of a flight risk than Johnny Gaudreau was in Calgary, for example. right? You know, Marner's in his hometown team playing for one of the biggest organizations in the league. It's very possible he wants to go elsewhere, right? And it's very possible he'll go to, like, the highest bidder, and I don't think the Leafs should be the highest bidder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, losing him for nothing is also pretty bad. And as a corollary to that, there are people who are sort of saying, like, hey, cap space is an asset. If you trade Marner for nothing, that's still useful. It helps you, like, retool. And yes, cap space is an asset, but it's an asset that you need to be able to use, right? So let's say you trade Marner for nothing but cap space. Just pretend all the other stuff that we talked about that makes this hard doesn't exist, right? He waives his no trade, whatever, or no move, whatever.
Yeah.
You have $11 million more in cap space than you expect. That's great. Who are you spending that on?
Yeah, and there are options, but none of them are gold-plated. You're not really getting a stud. Like,
no, so if you want to spend that money without giving up any further assets, you have to look at the free agency market. Free agency is rough this year. Very rough. If you want to acquire someone who is not a free agent, well, you have to trade for them, and you have to give up some assets to do so. As we covered, the Leafs are kind of asset poor as is.
Yes, they have their not that valuable first in 2024.
Which is probably going to be 23rd overall.
Yeah, they don't have their first in 2025. They have no second or third this year or next year, and they have no second the year after that. Like, they're going to have a hard time putting this together. So, yeah, I mean, I guess you're counting on the return from the Marner trade to be your asset injection. And as we've just said, that may not add up to a whole lot.
Right.
It depends on the market he allows you.
Yeah, and if you trade him for nothing, of course, then you get nothing back but cap space. And, you know, that probably isn't helping your team all that much in the immediate term.
Yeah, like, I think the most likely outcome of trading Mitch Marner is that in the short term, you get worse.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm not saying that's a reason you don't necessarily do it, but you've got to realize that that's what you're up against now. It's really difficult, unfortunately. There's no getting around that. So, yeah, that's kind of the big decision hanging over everything. You can also ask John Tavares to waive, but my guess is he says no. His cap hit is also kind of an additional no movement clause anyway.
Even if he says, so the cost for dumping 1 year of Patrick Marleau's $6.25 million cap hit was a first.
Yeah.
What happens when you double that?
Yeah.
Right. It's a bigger cap environment now, so it's not quite doubling. But
and you get like a guy who's still at minimum a middle six center.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, I don't think you come out asset positive at all. And like, if you're retaining a huge amount of money just to unload him for 1 year, I'm not even sure that's beneficial to you. Because look at the Leafs' center depth once he goes.
Probably also closes the door on him possibly signing like a lower value extension for like the last few years of his career.
Yeah.
Which maybe you think is like not a big deal. But and yeah, I mean, I do think, I don't think the Leafs should like box themselves into like signing John Tavares's age 35 plus seasons or anything like that.
No, it's just it's another thing that you think about. But to be clear, like, again, you can investigate this option. Mm-hmm. You can talk to him. You can canvas the market a little bit and see if there's anything there. I'm just, if you ask me, do I think that this will result in anything positive? No, I think he's going to stay in Toronto next season. But that's just my guess. I think the Leafs are going to extend Max Domi for many of the reasons we discussed. I hope it's not huge. We're going to be the first team that really committed to him after he shuffled through a lot of teams. But he did his job. He was worth his contract this year, and he helped them out in a jam in the playoffs. So, sure.
Being the team that finally marries Max Domi is a little bit scary. He's jumped around from team to team for a reason.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he has enough good traits that you can convince yourself, and teams have, and I think reasonably so, that like, okay, like this guy can be useful, and he has been useful for the Leafs, but there's a reason he's been on seven teams.
I have to say, can someone tell him to not look off the shot so hard on two-on-ones? He did it in one with Bertuzzi, where he got over the blue line on a two-on-one, and he slowed down immediately and turned his whole body facing laterally towards Bertuzzi. Like, he didn't show shot at all. And I was like, you've got to threaten it. at least a little bit. I know that that's like big mistaking him. He had a good series. Credit where it's due. I'm not against signing him to an extension. That's totally fine. This is that drove me nuts. So somebody can like sit him down and be like, just try to shoot it once in a while. My guess is Tyler Bertuzzi is gone. I wouldn't be uninterested in him, depending on the price. But I get the feeling that he's going to go and sign a big deal somewhere else now.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm curious what his market is. I think a star was higher last year than it is this year.
I would agree with that. And
is the increase in the cap enough to like offset that? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, it's iffy. I will say if I were in his position though, and I played the way that he plays especially, I would notice that I was 29 years old and I would start looking to lock up term now. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of those guys fall off a cliff hard. I saw someone suggest Brendan Gallagher as a comparable for him. And Gallagher got a big deal from the Montreal Canadiens that has been an albatross since the first year it came into effect. So, yeah, if I were him, I'd sign for term. TJ Brody, I think, is gone, sadly. You know?
Yeah, his decline this year was pretty notable. Mid-season, we were like, okay, he's still probably part of the Leafs' best six come playoff time. Because we were, pretty anchored to like how good he was in the prior season.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seemed to get worse and worse by the eye test. His numbers are actually not horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, by RAPM, he's about average. But the fact that everyone who has watched the Leafs seems to think, okay, this guy's cooked, and like no one seems to be that upset about him being scratched, is probably indicative of something.
Yeah, no, I think the end has come. Like, I think he's probably better than it felt like at certain points this year, but he is in steep decline, you know? Could you play him as a sixth defenseman and be fine? I suspect somebody will, but the Leafs have got to get bigger priorities. Mark Giordano is going to be done, unfortunately. God bless him. He deserved better, but sports are cruel. Timothy Liljegren is a restricted free agent, and the Leafs do need right-handed shots on D. So I think that they will end up keeping him, but I have to say he's probably kind of sick of still being on the edge of the roster this far into his career. Like, you know, still getting scratched some games in the playoffs, not really having the trust of the coaching staff, and, you know, maybe it's a new coaching staff. But I don't think that that's necessarily heading towards a long-term marriage. Like, he'll stay but we'll see.
He should be cheap, and he's an RFA, which is basically like you're not even human at that point, so.
Yeah, unfortunately, you don't have a ton of leverage. He does have arb rights, but again, I don't think that's going to end in a bank-breaking deal. It's just the more likely thing is he has a short deal coming out of this one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
And this one maybe ends UFA, so we'll see. I suspect the Leafs are going to chase the closest they can get to a stud defenseman. Obviously, this depends somewhat on the Mitch Marner thing. I'm sure if they do go down that route, they would love to get the defenseman in return for Mitch Marner. If you're looking at UFA names, Brett Pesce is interesting to me. He's going to be in demand as a right defenseman, though, and I don't know how he's going to look outside the force field of the Carolina Hurricanes. So that may be a pause.
Yeah, it's tricky. So, the other thing is there's like the very cursed option of, and again, this is probably more fun to think about than likely to actually occur.
Mm-hmm.
But wouldn't it be so Vegas to trade Petrangelo for Marner?
It would. They would 100% do that.
They would. Now, both people involved have no move clauses.
Yeah.
As I said, very unlikely to actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know why Petrangelo would want to come here.
Well, he does have family in King City, which is near Toronto. That's all I can think of. But
yeah.
Yeah.
By that logic, you know, half the league should
but there's always a chance. Yeah, no, yeah. I hear you.
But like that seems like this type of deal that I can see the Leafs wanting to go for. And to be clear, I think that would be kind of a disaster for them.
It feels like it would go badly, yeah, because Petrangelo is 34. He's still signed for 3 years after this one at 8.8. And so, yeah, you maybe end up paying for some decline years that are kind of painful. But yeah, yes. If everyone's in big move mode, you never know what can happen.
This is the other thing to note with a Marner trade and why we should be like sort of cautious about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know who sucked in the playoffs for the Leafs for a long time? Zach Hyman. You know who has like 35 bajillion points since going to Edmonton in the playoffs?
Yep.
It is so incredibly foreseeable that the Leafs trade Mitch Marner at the nadir of his value to some team, and then he puts up 17 points in 14 playoff games.
Yeah. Look at Nazem Kadri. Same old thing. You know, they said, okay, you can't trust him not to get suspended in the playoffs. And then he didn't get suspended in the playoffs, even though that they probably could have suspended him. And he was lifting the cup with the Avalanche. So who knows? But yeah, like there's no way when you let Mitch Marner go that you don't have at least several moments where you're like, oh, Jesus, he scored 1 billion points for whoever. Like, I think that's inevitable. It's just a question of, is there some path to making this team the contender that it ought to be? Because all of those roads look pretty hard and pretty long from where we're sitting right now. The biggest remaining thing is goaltending. And so the Leafs could do the platoon thing again. The feeling I get, and it's just a feeling, so I could be very wrong, is that they're going to want someone a bit more established as a 1A to go alongside Joseph Woll next year. Jake Allen, if he doesn't stay with the New Jersey Devils, if they make a big acquisition, could shake loose. The Bruins have been rumored to be trading Ullmark for a while, although who knows if they trade in division and what they would demand. Jacob Markstrom in Calgary has been available for a while, and the New Jersey Devils have not met the asking price yet. All of those names occur to me as guys who might pair with Woll to start a pairing. Obviously, if you're paying your starting goalie a lot, you are going to be squeezed financially elsewhere.
Yeah. Not a great goalie UFA class either. Mm. You know, you get some like backups to stars who have like decent numbers. Scott Wedgwood, Laurent Brossois, Anthony Stolarz are examples. But, you know, no one's signing those guys being like, oh, cool, here's our starter.
Yeah. And so if you're doing that, then you're just trying to really cheap out and hope for the best.
You're trying to platoon again, right? Yeah. Maybe Martin Jones comes back and like you have a three-way competition more or less, and you cobble together league averages goaltending by the combination of all three of them.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we've kind of discounted the possibility because that's just how it feels, but like it wouldn't be the most insane thing in the world if they re-signed Ilya Samsonov. I don't think he's great, to be clear.
No.
But if they're trying to platoon it again, then they can kind of rationalize it as well. What else are we doing? It does feel a little bit like maybe it's time for that to wrap up. But yeah, I mean, the big takeaway again is you have to consider almost anything possible because this team is simply not where it needs to be. And that would be the case if they had snuck by Boston again, instead of losing to them. It would feel better, but the overall outlook would not be that different. And that's really what we're grappling with now.
Pretty much. All right, cool. Anything else that you want to discuss?
No, I think that was enough of a downer.
Cool. Yeah, so we'll be back intermittently through the offseason. We'll probably do the offseason roundups where we spend 35 hours talking through the remaining 31 NHL teams. We'll probably talk about the Leafs a little bit more when they make trades. Obviously, if they make, you know, a big trade, or a big coaching change, we might hop back on and discuss that. But thank you all for sticking with us for another season of Back to Excited. You can catch all of mine and Fuleman's work at PensionPlanPuppets.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at RV and AT Fuleman. Take care. We'll see you next time.